From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Marketing Matters on Business Radio.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Marketing Matters here on Business Radio, Sirius XM 132. I'm Barbara Kahn, the Patty and J.H. Baker Professor of Marketing. And today, for our luxury edition of Marketing Matters, Americus Reed is on the road, so he cannot be here. But he will be back next week with his usual terrific commentary and point of view. Our guest is Pauline Brown, who's a longtime leader in the luxury goods sector. She's a pioneer in the business of aesthetics. She formerly served as the chairman of LVMH North America, where she provided regional leadership for 70 brands in five sectors in the luxury business, luxury vertical, including fashion, beauty, jewelry, wines and spirits, and specialty retail. And she's now recently been an executive in residence and teaching courses at Columbia University. So she's really been keeping her hand at everything active in luxury. And we're delighted to have her here to talk about what's going on in the luxury industry today. Hello, Pauline, and thank you so much for being here.
Barbara, great to see you. I always enjoy our conversations.
Yeah, it's really fun to hear what you think about things. And I know you have your own point of view. And you are our business. You're in charge of LVMH North America. But you've since written a book on aesthetic intelligence and really are very good in the visual aspect, in the design aspect, and can do that side of it, too. And I think that's kind of rare in the industry.
Well, in my case, it probably helps that I'm left-handed. So, you know, on the downside of being left-handed, we're all kind of, a bit confused. And it took me a long time to even know my right from my left. And I actually, unlike Stuart, I really came at the world of fashion and design strictly through the business lens. In fact, my first job after Wharton, and this is going on 30 years now, when I graduated, was at Bain. And I often call my chapter at Bain, and I'm talking Bain Consulting, not private equity or venture capital, but that was really my Wharton part two.
Yeah.
And by the time I left that, and I got what I now consider my first real job, which was at Estee Lauder, I really think that was my awakening. That was, I'll never forget the day that I put a deck down in front of my then CEO, my then boss. He was the COO of the company, eventually CEO. I had done everything that I was trained to do from Wharton to Bain and trained to do very well in terms of analyzing the competitive marketplace and coming up with a strategy that I thought was, you know, robust and defensible and rational and going to be well received by the market. And he slammed it down. I don't even think he said, this is not where the business happens. And he forced me, had I not listened to him, I would have clearly been fired, but he forced me to think about the business, not so much through the lens of an observer, but through the empathy of a buyer. Why is any woman willing to spend much more for an Estee Lauder or a MAC lipstick? What are they actually experiencing at that moment of truth? And I think once I was able to dissect that, it really changed my thinking about what a brand is and how we could get emotionally closer to consumers, which is unfortunately still not widely taught in business schools or in big corporations.
No, that's really interesting, because when I look at you, I see someone with impeccable taste, and you're a beautiful woman and you dress impeccably. And every time I ever see you, you just really have amazing taste. So it seems to me that I don't see everybody with that. So I appreciate when I see that with you.
But you say that, but when I've been in a room with Anna Wintour, she will sneer. clearly I wouldn't know the difference between what's hot this year and what's hot 2 years ago or 2 years from now. So I do have my own taste, and I'm willing to stick with it. But I guess it's all relative, right?
Yeah, but like what I think that's kind of what you did write about in your book, Aesthetic Intelligence, and what you're teaching now. I mean, I see that you have online courses. I know you taught that course at Harvard. I'm not sure what you're teaching at Columbia now, but I know you've been really coming up with that idea, and it's this idea of sensual delight or emotional experience and how you build a brand. And it's not just visual. It's all the senses, I think. But it is some kind of, just as you're describing, you were told to do, maybe you came upon it, you know, by force rather than intuitively, but you've since learned it. And I think that is the magic of luxury also. To not understand that would be to not understand luxury.
Yeah. I mean, I always say, you know, if you take, for example, my last day job at LVMH, you have a company that at the time was generating over $50 billion a year in revenue. It's quite a bit larger today. Has 70 plus different brands, 5 plus different luxury sectors, over 100 markets around the world that they sell those products in. And it doesn't make one thing that anyone needs. And so if luxury isn't able to do aesthetics well, it doesn't have a right to exist. You know, nobody needs champagne. Nobody needs a watch. They certainly don't need it in this day and age of our, you know, digital devices. But that doesn't stop them from buying, and buying with enthusiasm. Nobody, you know, buys it reluctantly. People are very excited to be buying these kind of luxury products. So the experience at LVMH forced me, and my experiences at Estee Lauder years before, to really think about, why do people spend more? What are they really looking for? If it really was about utility, they could do things much more rationally and much cheaper. And I don't think that that is just a concept that is required of luxury. I think increasingly technology companies and financial services companies, every company I look at, needs to think about what are they communicating from an emotional resonance point, and how are they communicating? How are they talking about why they matter, and how are they connecting with their customer? And those that do it well are get outsized rewards.
Yeah, you know, so let's bring us back to this notion of luxury, you know, and I agree with you, though, that some of these ideas apply to other types of industries. But it is kind of interesting to look specifically at luxury, and that has been a lot of your career, I know. And one of the things that I've seen you've been talking to a lot of different media about this issue, because it's kind of interesting that luxury is coming away from the pandemic bubble, where they did really well and the luxury was showing really good numbers. And luxury numbers are softer now than they've been. And a lot of it is being attributed to the aspirational buyer. So the person who still values the high-end buyer, who still values that luxury that you're talking about, that seems to be pretty robust market. But a lot of the softness in the market comes from these aspirational buyers. What sometimes people call them Henrys, high earners, not rich yet, those kind of people, who are not buying the luxury products the way they used to. Do you have a thought about what's happening in the industry right now?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you're absolutely right. The luxury industry itself has become more and more bifurcated between these high-performing, very disciplined players. I'm thinking of at the highest end, Hermes, Ferrari, Rolex, Dom Perignon. Those companies are not feeling any pullback, right? Because what they do today is not that different than what they did years ago, 10 years ago, 100 years ago. And their pricing power and their scarcity gives them extraordinary command, even in times where demand seems to be pulling back. So there's a small group, but a very powerful group of brands that have withstood the trend line that you just described. The vast majority of what we're calling luxury, and that will range from the, you know, Estee Lauders of the world to the Ralph Laurens to even the Vuittons at the higher end, they have become so commercial. And the wave that they were riding these last many years was never sustainable. There, you know, if you think about what is luxury, it really goes back to some very basic tenets: hard to find, hard to make, last forever. There's nothing in an Estee Lauder brand that is hard to make. It's all made in a factory and increasingly in third-party manufacturing facilities. It's not hard to find. You can click in a finger and increasingly even do so on Amazon, but if not Amazon, in any number of other sites. And it isn't really built to have any sort of keepsake value. It's built to respond to the here and the now. It's a consumer economy approach. And that is not luxury. It is premium, but I think that the gap between those brands that have commanded premium prices but really weren't all that luxurious and the mass market ones, you know, on the cosmetic front, I would put like an e.l.f. in that category. The wax in an e.l.f. lipstick is no less quality than the wax in a MAC lipstick. And I think that that gap has narrowed, and therefore the pricing differential or the value proposition, at least of the higher end ones, is no longer there. So part of what we're seeing is not simply a post-pandemic issue. I think it's a rationalization. I think the consumer is waking up to what really has value over time, what really matters, and what has just been somewhat exploitive.
Oh, well, that's a strong position. That's very interesting. But to your point, Hermès has not seen the downturn that some of the others, and even raised the prices of their purses, you know. So it shows that their value is very strong.
Chanel, every upper-end brand, Prada, they've all raised their prices. But for Hermès and a small number, very small number of others, maybe Cartier I'd put there as well, there's no resistance. To Tiffany, there is resistance. You know, to Dior, there's going to be more resistance than to Chanel. So my point being, you know, they've all been playing a similar game, but certain players like Hermès have been so disciplined that even with the pricing inflation that they've exercised, they still have more demand than supply. If they wanted to triple their sales tomorrow, they could. It would hurt them in 10 years from now, and they don't run the business for the next 5 to 10 years. They run it for the next 100. And so for that reason, their valuations have stayed very, very healthy.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. There's a couple other things. I mean, so I agree with what you're saying. I think that's strongly stated, but I do think I agree with the general trend. But there are other trends also, and I've heard you talk about these too, so I know they're not alien to you. But this idea that some of it has to do with one of the things that was happening during the pandemic was people were not traveling. They were stuck at home, so maybe they were buying certain things at that time. Now that we're kind of on the tail end of the pandemic, there's a lot more travel, a lot more money being put into hospitality, into experiences. And so that's also a change for some historic luxury. But some of the luxury companies are following in that suit. I know Louis Vuitton is opening up a restaurant, which is kind of interesting. I've seen you mention it, and I've been there in the flagship Dior store in France, in Paris. They have a lovely little cafe. So do you think that's a direction that makes sense for these luxury brands? You know, because you're talking about a discipline, a real legacy that luxury has to control. Does it make sense for them to expand into this hospitality and experiential world as well?
Well, up to a point. I mean, first of all, from an economic standpoint, a really high-performing a restaurant, a hotel. Louis Vuitton is going to open a hotel in Paris in the coming years. I would say a high-performing one can generate an EBITDA of 10-12%, which is quite a bit less than a high-performing personal luxury product. Mm-hmm. And so I don't see them scaling that in any way. I think they're doing it because they're trying to create a 360 experience around the products where they actually make money, which are their handbags, their shoes, for some of the brands, their jewelry. None of the brands, by the way, in that category, not Dior, not Chanel, not Vuitton, will make money on ready-to-wear. That's an unprofitable segment of their business. They still do their shows every year. They just did them in the fashion weeks in Paris and Milan. They do them because it gets editorial attention, obviously a more and more social media buzz. It keeps them relevant. Nobody's writing about a never full bag, but they are writing about what Nicolas Gasquer showed on the runway. But they lose money on those shows. And I think for a similar reason, if they can operate these hotels and restaurants well, they'll continue to do so to a point. But the risk that they run, and the reason you won't see the second tier or the more mid-sized brands go into hospitality, is because if you don't do it well, it'll come back to haunt you. Have you ever stayed at a hotel where maybe the decor was exquisite, but the room service was a nightmare? Yeah. I mean, you'll never go back.
Yeah.
And so the competencies it takes are a bit daunting for a company that doesn't have deep, deep pockets.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. And I agree also, it does build brand and it's building something else, something experiential, but it may not be their long-term strategy. The other thing that people talk about with luxury, of course, is the role of the Chinese consumer and what they're doing and whether or not they're investing in European luxury to the degree they used to. Because I know a lot of the time, like in 2008 and right around there, 2009, in that recession, China and some of that was really what helped luxury stay alive. So what's the role of the Chinese consumer now in luxury?
Well, good news, bad news. I mean, the good news is that it's become a big market and it's not going away, right? The Chinese are still devouring a lot of luxury. The bad news is they're not devouring it in the same way that they were just a few years ago. What took probably 40 years for the American consumer to go from this sort of middle class, aspirational middle class, wealthy, in some cases, ultra wealthy, and they're increasing sophistication as they sort of moved along the economic spectrum. I would say a lot of the Chinese luxury buy done in about a quarter of the time. So they've become a very discriminating customer. And so to point number one, what was an easy sale 10, 20 years ago takes a lot more investment and effort and care by these luxury players today. Number two, in the early days and really leading up to, I would say, the last 5 years, the vast majority of Chinese consumption of luxury goods happened outside of China. It happened as they were traveling. In fact, in some cases, because of the price differential, it actually justified a trip to Europe in order to get the bag or the jewelry or whatever they were seeking, because it covered the trip, because with the surcharge on luxury imports to China, things would be 30% or more expensive, more expensive at home. That differential has closed. And I think during COVID, there was such an impetus to open local stores to capture that consumer where they live that no longer do they see traveling abroad as the way to access that which they can get at home. And that has changed both the economic model for a lot of these players, but it's also changed where the distribution of revenues are coming from. And the last point I'd make is, you know, as big as the market is, nobody looking at it rationally thought that it would continue to grow at the rate that it was growing 6, 7, 8 years ago. And the companies that overinvested, and I'm thinking specifically Estee Lauder and some of the Kering brands, for example, they overinvested in that local market, and now they're feeling the price of they're feeling the effects, and looking for a more balanced distribution. Sadly, for all these companies, their local business, meaning Europe-based shopping, has suffered the biggest blow in many cases, because of the lack of travel and the fact that Europeans don't buy luxury in the same way that travelers and Americans and Chinese do.
Yeah, that is interesting. So that's where that's explaining some of the pain behind some of these luxury numbers. And this isn't really about the pain of it, but it's more about the future. And I've also seen you discuss something on this too. So one of the things, and you alluded to this with Hermes and some of these other really big Chanel, Rolex brands, where they really do have that long, long history and they look at for the long run, a lot of what they're building is this legacy, the handmade, things that they've done. And like you said, Hermes doesn't change their business. They've done the same business for years and years and years. But in embracing the new consumer and thinking about what Gen Alpha or Gen Z might care about, there are differences in values in those younger consumers. And you do see some brands trying to balance their heritage with trying to be modern and contemporary. And Louis Vuitton with Pharrell Williams, you know, taking on that as a new designer, and or Tiffany with Beyonce and Jay-Z. What is your thought about that kind of balance and whether or not these long-term heritage brands can be modern and should embrace new culture?
Yeah, I think it's very tricky. I mean, first of all, let me say that Pharrell and Beyonce are a lot closer to my age than they are to my daughter's age.
Okay.
So I'm not sure that that particular association is what's going to get next generation in. Second of all, next generation, they certainly have dreams. It's why luxury has been around as long as mankind has in some form or another, even if it wasn't commercialized. But their dreams are quite different than their parents. And I don't think they're as well satisfied by some high status brand. I don't think that feels cool to them, something that would be mainstream and massified. At the same time, I look at myself when I was my daughter's age, and I'm not the same person, you know, a generation later. And one of the mistakes that many marketers make is they sort of look at a population and they project forward and they assume certain values will stay. And I sort of say, you know what? The minute that the millennials could afford to buy their first home, it took them a long time, longer than their parents, but then they did, they started to shift their purchasing and their priorities as well. I think a lot of the younger generation are still evolving, and maybe evolving in a different way than we've known before, but they certainly are not going to stay consistent or constant. And by the way, even in their current current decision making, there's a lot of conflicting behavior. So there's no generation that talks more about sustainability than these Gen Zs. And at the same time,
they
can't get enough of
right, exactly.
They can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
And you know, and by the way, I don't blame them. I'm just calling it out. I think that that level of sort of conflict and in some cases hypocrisy, I think we see it at all stages of life. But I think we have to recognize that what people say and what they do is not always one and the same.
Just out of curiosity, have you seen Pharrell's new collection? Do you have an opinion of it?
Yes, I do. Well, first of all, the clothes don't matter, right? In fact, if I asked 1,000 people, even those that might have even taken a quick glance at the runway or some of the snapshots that made its way through social media or through traditional media, I think 1% or less will remember a single item, you know, particularly when it comes to the ready wear. What Pharrell is doing, which is what Louis Vuitton brand is leveraging, is an attitude. And it's an attitude about what's happening in the zeitgeist that, in this case, he and his culture or his circle are trying to tap into. I think there was a time, and it's long gone, where whether you were the editor of a big publication or the designer of an influential maison fashion house, that it actually set the culture. I don't think that happens anymore. I think the best of them, and I think Marc Jacobs still does this well. I think the design team at Alexander McQueen is doing this well. I think there's a handful. The best of them are really just capturing a culture that's happening. I think so. I guess I'm saying a few things in my response to your question. Number one, I from the beginning, I knew that when he was appointed, he wasn't appointed for his fashion chops. He's not a designer in the traditional sense, the way that Karl Lagerfeld was, or, you know, many other people I might point to. He doesn't sketch. He doesn't, you know, fabricate. He doesn't sew. If he does, it's sort of at an amateur level. He's a stylist. And he's an entertainer. And I think he knows how to create a moment. But I think his moments, as I say, when they're good, are really creating something that is just leveraging what's already happening out there, whether it's on the street or in Hollywood or wherever else they're looking for inspiration. But I think it's, I don't look to that. I don't know anybody that I would call a real tastemaker who's looking to those kind of shows to sort of set the path or to shape what their own fashion choices will be going forward.
That's very interesting perspective.
What do you think?
I don't know. Now that I hear what you say, I agree with you. You know, but I just think it's fun and it creates interest and excitement, and that's exactly what you're saying. And that's what attracted me. You know, we're out of time. I can't believe that you're just so interesting and have so much to say. Pauline, it was so wonderful to have you join us. Thank you so much. And where can our listeners go to keep up with your conversations and what you're doing? What's the place to reach you now?
Yeah, thanks for asking, and thanks for having me. Well, I do have a show on SiriusXM. It's also on the Business Channel. It's called The Other AI, which, contrary to the AI everyone's talking about, The Other AI is Aesthetic Intelligence, which is also the title of the book that I wrote, came out a few years ago. It's related to the course that I teach at Columbia, which is called The Marketing of Aesthetics and Experiences. So I would say you can either listen to me on this channel 132. It plays on the weekends, or you can listen on the app. You can follow me. You can take a look at, I have a newsletter. You can go to aestheticintelligence.com and subscribe.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And we'd like to thank our producers, Dion Simpkins and Dana Cash. We're here every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and we replay our show several times throughout the week. You can follow our show and see our history, our shelf of podcasts, if you want, if you go to Knowledge at Wharton and in the podcast tab, and you'll see our show, Marketing Matters, there. And you can also follow Business Radio at SXM Business for information about all our programming. Thank you all for listening today. We'll be back next week. Till then, this has been Marketing Matters. I'm Barbara Kahn, here with America's Read, Business Radio, SiriusXM 132.